You're listening to Creative Thursday, episode number 194. Welcome to Creative Thursday with Marisa Ann Cummings. We're talking all things life, business, and creativity intended to inspire and empower you wherever you are on your creative journey, both personally and professionally. Thank you for listening. Hi, hello, it's Marisa here with episode number 3 of the season 2 of Creative Thursday. And today I have a very special guest, another very special guest, artist, illustrator, writer extraordinaire, greeting card writer extraordinaire, Emily McDowell. So where do I even begin with this episode? I'm coming to you with 3 more episodes left, and I told you that at the end of this series, I'm going to give you the full behind the scenes of how this came to be and how this particular season and getting it complete was such a challenge. And this was one of the episodes that was the most challenging, and I'll just give you the heads up if you also look at the video version on youtube.com/Creative Thursday. And part of the reason this was so challenging, hello Pepita, good to see you. Part of the reason this one was so challenging in particular is I had gotten a very nice head start on season 2. I learned a lot from season 1, and you know, that's the goal, right? As a business owner, you get one project under your belt and then you feel like, okay, how can we make this more efficient for the next time? So I was already recording episodes before I launched my second Kickstarter. And a few days before the second Kickstarter was about to close, and we were also leaving on a 5-week trip to Europe. So wonderful. We are absolutely thinking about that every day right now. It was such a special trip that we had. It was one of the trips where I led my painting retreat in the south of France. And we took a couple of extra weeks of holiday time and to see my family in Germany. And we were getting ready to leave, and I realized that all the video was taking up a lot of space, as video often does, and I knew I needed to get a new hard drive. And I did. I got a new hard drive. I didn't want to take any chances on having anything happen to all this work. And so as I was formatting the new hard drive, which happened to be the same brand as my existing hard drive, I didn't realize that the one I was formatting was my existing hard drive, which means I erased my existing hard drive with all of the video and audio thus far, of which Emily's episode, Christine's, Elisa's, all of the first 3 episodes were a part of. I believe the next one was as well. It was. And I let out a scream like no other. It was just, let's just say I've been working digitally for over 20 years. I started my career in the digital space with computers, and I've had a lot of things happen. I learned Control S. I learned to save often because of how many times all these programs used to crash, way more than they do now. I've learned those very painful lessons of work being completed and lost for just a simple error. And to have this happen days before I would leave, in that moment thinking, I have just lost 3 episodes worth of video and audio. And clearly, these are shot over a period of time. And while I could invite my guests back, there's a lot that goes into each episode. And the thought of redoing all of them again, it just, all of that just felt like way too much to handle, because I was creating these in the space of trying to squeeze them in to a full-time job and the work that I'm already presently doing. And so it was already a lot of time, and it just obviously it felt devastating in that moment. Also, you don't want to lose something that's a moment in time that you captured. And so the short version of the story is, after I screamed so loud and Sean was startled, he instantly went online and started searching for me to figure out how to recover that. And the one thing I learned, so hopefully in this little bit longer intro and backstory to the series, I can impart some wisdom to you. Don't power your computer off. Don't unplug the hard drive. Turn off nothing. Because I hadn't turned anything off, we were able to find software that would do its best to recover what had been erased. Basically, when you format something, it's really erased. It's not like putting it in the trash and emptying the trash. It's the formatting is meant to clean it, wipe it clean, nothing left, no space. So we just, fingers crossed, and it wasn't just those files. There were a lot of other video files as well, some of which are very personal to me, history to my work. It was a lot of different files on that one hard drive. So, long story short, actually it happened pretty quick. It did restore them. It did. It restored a ton of the files. It was incredible. It was miraculous. Sean absolutely saved the day and saved our trip that we were going on. I'm sure I would have found a way to enjoy myself. I know it's all relative. Let's keep it in perspective. In that moment, it just felt heartbreaking. And also one of those moments where I wasn't being careless. I was trying to take extra steps to not be careless, and it ended up costing me what I was trying to save anyway. You know those moments where you sort of go, really? Really? Okay. I can understand if I just never backed them up, but I did, and I erased them. So moving on, we made it through. What happens though is, first of all the files come out with just random numbers, so you have to find them all. And then a number of them were corrupt, which means they were recovered, but I lost huge portions of video. And it just put a massive delay on the project, partly because I was heartbroken by that. I didn't want to go redo certain parts of it. This is probably just silly and in my mind, but I didn't want to be a bother. We were filming them at our guests' homes, and, you know, it can be a little inconvenient to have people come in and film you. So I just didn't want to go through that whole process again. And thankfully, I really didn't need to. But I share this part of the story with you specifically to Emily's episode, because hers was the one that was hit the hardest. And by that, I mean, really, we just lost the first 8 minutes of video of both of us. There's me. That's why you'll see me just by myself in the beginning. And we lost actually more, almost, well, no, we lost almost all of Emily's individually until the very end. So the beauty of that is that I was able to add a ton of imagery specific to Emily's story. And because she has done such a great job documenting her own story, there were images of so many details to the story that she shares she had available. So I put those in place, and the episode still turned out really beautiful. I know that you'll enjoy it, but I really miss having all the footage we shot. But we have an episode versus not having an episode, or having a video episode versus only having an audio. And it's okay, right? We talk about this all the time. Done is better than perfect. And while I care extra because these stories involve more than just me, they are also representing my guests, and I want them to be the best representation possible. I know, and they know, this was a big undertaking for someone who is not a professional videographer, who also happened to have a hard drive crisis midway through. But we had audio because I also had that backed up on a separate, not the hard drive, but the device we were recording the audio on. So that's another little pro tip I can give you. Until all the pieces of your video are put together, if you have extra camera cards or audio recording cards, keep everything there too, if it's not taking up too much space. Because I knew when that happened in that instant, so I thought, well, worst case scenario, I can make a podcast. Best case scenario, I can make a podcast. Here we are, and a video. So here we are. We have both, and the most intact is the audio recording of which you are about to listen to. So it is my pleasure to introduce you to Emily McDowell, writer, illustrator, and as she also refers to herself, feeling translator. What's beautiful about this episode is Emily really details the start to Emily McDowell, her brand, which is now also Emily McDowell and Friends. A lot has transpired since we recorded this episode within her business. She started her business in 2012, and as she says, with $5,000 and 11th grade math skills, and she grew it to just a huge business. I'm going to let you tell her the story, and I look forward to one day having the opportunity to share what happened after we had this conversation and where Emily is now. And she started this because she saw a huge hole in the marketplace problem, a problem that needed to be solved in her mind because she couldn't find any cards that reflected her reality, including empathy cards. She's a cancer survivor, and she felt like a get well soon card for someone going through cancer just didn't make any sense in a certain way. And it's true. I remember talking to her and saying, Emily, will you please design a line for women going through fertility challenges? There aren't any cards for that, actually. So maybe one day this will happen. It's true. We're asking for a level of honesty and transparency now more than ever. And so Emily's greeting cards, I don't even know if you call them greeting cards, her card line really hit at the perfect time. And I think to get a true essence of her, she's great on Instagram. You can follow her at Emily McDowell _. Or she has also really been speaking a lot of truths into a more, I don't know if you would call it a spiritual side or just philosophical side. And you can find her at Emily on Life. And there are a number of podcast interviews with her as well. So you may find one that gives the more up to date of what's happened. But this episode was also unique in that it was a bit of a perfect storm the day that we recorded it, both for me, not quite as much or to the degree of stress for Emily, but I remember being in tears the day that we recorded, and we were having personal crises at home with our animals. We realized that our cat was ill, and it's, you know, again, It's all relative and simultaneously when your cat of 19 years, something that is also very dear to Emily's heart. She had a deep connection with her cat, Stan. All of her Instagram friends knew Stan and followed him. He also makes a little appearance in this video if you spot him. And there is something particularly deep about the connection with the animals that also inspire us and are with us on our journeys of finding our voice as an artist and building our business. The cat that was ill for me was Garbo, and I know many of you were connected to her. I used to blog about her, and she was with me through most of this very early journey to my business. And so I arrived feeling off balance, which Emily didn't know. And then when I went to interview her, she let me know that she had just found out that she would be spending her entire weekend recreating or relisting products on the website. Could she outsource it? We talk a little bit about it in this episode. Yes, but by the time she explained it to everyone with such short notice, she just decided she would do it herself. And she had told me, not on this episode, that she had also discovered that she had licensed to a company and it was a terrible mistake. She had given up a portion of her company and realized that she needed to pull her company back out of that partnership. So this combination of stress, I can only imagine how Emily must have really been feeling, and to still stick with it and to graciously keep her commitment and keep the episode going in the midst of so much chaos and stress and being on the verge of burnout. I know these were those moments that ultimately led to Emily making a lot of very profound personal and career changes and pivots, from changing the way she was eating to traveling. I know she's been to Bali several times, to relocating from LA to Portland, to combining forces with two other stationery companies, Knock Knock and People, Places, and Things, to form the Who's There group. And she's also collaborating with other artists and writers under the umbrella of Emily McDowell and Friends. So many changes in such a short span of time. And it all happened really fast for Emily. This is a great account of how when things click into place, they can skyrocket. And you better hang on tight and get ready. And Emily now has a lot of guidance, as you can imagine, and thoughts on how to help other artists or stationery creators, illustrators, and writers to maybe not have to go through all the growing pains that she did. She's great about sharing her story with, as you can imagine, if you know her brand, a lot of genuine honesty and transparency and kindness and heart and no messing around. Keeping it real, as Emily would say, one of my favorite cards by her, you are doing a fucking great job. So Emily's doing a fucking great job. It was an honor to have this conversation with her, especially again under such stressful circumstances for all involved on a very hot summer day in Los Angeles. And without further ado, enjoy my conversation with Emily McDowell. I
I was thinking it could be interesting to start with, that's sort of an odd way to start, but this idea you were writing to me when I was coming over that you're going through crisis, and this idea that we are, you know, that we're presenting so much all the time to the world where things seem seamless, as sometimes they are.
Right.
But every business owner goes through crisis on different levels. And sometimes I just feel like people aren't aware of that. Like, we're just always presenting this one way of doing business. But when you know that that's normal to some degree in all these various ways, it can help, I think.
I think so. This was only a crisis because I thought I was done last night, and then there was a huge, big chunk that needs to get redone over the weekend. So it's just figuring out when I'm going to have the time to do that, because we're launching a new website on Monday.
and this is all work
that needs to happen between now and Monday. That stuff needs to get redone. The site can't launch without it. So, and it's hard. Like, when you own a business, at the end of the day, it's you. It all comes down to you getting it done. And whether you have the means to pay someone else to get it done or not, you still have to then manage that person and, like, deal with that person and provide resources to that person. So it's really hard to hand work off. And I thought about trying to do that this weekend, but it's going to be faster and I'm going to feel better if I just do it. So I'm just going to do it.
Yeah. When do you make that decision? Like, when do you make that call? Because you started this just solo,
right?
And then you grew, and we'll get to talk about that. But that decision, I've been thinking about that often because I just brought some part-time help again. Mm-hmm. And that question of when do I actually hand this over, or when do I just get it done?
Right. And I think it's a really hard balance. When I grew, it was just really clear immediately that I needed someone to help with the sales end of things, because we launched at wholesale when it was just me. And immediately we needed someone to help me just getting orders in and talking to stores and sales reps and dealing with all
this.
This
was the first trade show you went to?
This was the first trade show I went to in May 2013. It was the National Stationery Show in 2013.
In New York.
In New York. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the time I was just working, I was freelancing in advertising still. I was working out of my bedroom, our spare bedroom in our old house. And, I really had no idea what would happen when I launched this collection. I had stuff that I had work that had gone viral online. I had an Etsy shop that was increasingly popular. I was still freelancing on the side. And I thought, oh, I'll just launch this line and then I'm going to just do this more and more, and this will ramp up along with my Etsy shop. And then at some point I'll be able to quit advertising and go into this full time. And that happened, but the timeline was just like within a week versus a year, which was kind of what I was expecting. So immediately it was like needing a studio space, needing some help, needing a system infrastructure to be able to support what was happening.
Is this because it went viral?
It's because we got orders from about 35 stores at the show, and then Urban Outfitters placed like a $25,000 order at the show.
Wow.
And they needed the stuff to them like 2.5 weeks later. And I hadn't even printed the cards yet at the time. They were at a printer and they were lined up to be printed, but I wanted to, rather than saying, because you have to print a minimum of like 1,000 per style if you're going to do an offset run. And so I had decided, I'm going to wait until after the show to tell them how many to print, because what if I go to the show and I don't get any orders? Like, I don't want to print 50,000 cards and, you know,
store them in the spare bedroom.
Right. And like, I also had no real concept of what 50,000 cards took up, like cubic foot wise.
Yeah. How,
like,
how would
I
you
was
know
thinking that?
That
I could store them in my bedroom. But as it turned out, because of the Urban order and because of the orders we got, we ended up printing something, it was like 88,000 cards. And when I first told, the reason we needed a studio was because I told the printer, like, yeah, you'll just deliver them to my house. And he was like, what do you mean? Like, where are you going to put them? And I was like, well, I work out of, you know, our spare bedroom. And he was like, you could, like, build a house with these. Like, do you understand that this is, like, four pallets stacked 5 feet high? And, like, I'm guessing that won't fit in your spare room. And he was correct. And so I had to really quickly find a studio space. And I had no idea, like, is this going to work? Is this going to, you know, is Urban Outfitters going to order once and, like, never order again?
Right.
And, but the way that I figured was, well, the check that is coming for these 25,000 cards in 30 days will cover the rent on my space for a year, if nothing else. And
see what happens.
So, you know, like, it was just kind of an experiment. The first space I got was really small. It was, like, in downtown before downtown got crazy expensive, and it was in, like, you know, kind of a drafty, like, it was a little bit of a slumlord situation where the dude just kind of didn't care. And so it was not, like, the greatest in terms of amenities, as in, like, there was, like, not, like, it leaked and it was holes in the roof and stuff. Like, I say amenities in a really, like, loose way. I'm not, like, talking about a jacuzzi. I'm talking about, like, you know, a roof. But no, it was fine for, like, what we did and what we needed, and it was a place to put stuff, and we moved out of it. We ended up moving out of it 6 months later.
So basically, you really had no choice but to just jump in.
Yeah.
Full on and just get the help you need and the space you needed. It's just, there was no, like,
right.
And I didn't know how to figuring it out.
You know? No, because it was like this order would be canceled if it didn't get to their distribution center in, like, 2.5 weeks. And so I had to figure out how to make that work. And so I found like friends of friends, Facebook, Instagram. I had like 100 Instagram followers. I mean, it was like tiny, 500, whatever. And assembled this sort of like motley crew of people for 3 or 4 days. My friend Shayna Fraze, who's an amazing painter, let me use her studio, which was in the studio. So she actually hooked me up with her landlord, which is how we ended up in the studio we ended up in.
Okay.
It was down the hall from the studio she had at the time. And so Shayna said, you know, we just did all this card assembly. I just did this big order for another retailer. I actually ended up going out and buying all these tables and stuff so people could sit down. So you can use that if you want to, which was amazing of her and saved me. Like, you can bring people in and spend like 3 or 4 days just like packing all this stuff up, which was so nice. So
yeah.
I ended up using her space and actually having the cards delivered to her space at first before mine was ready, because we were moving in like at the same time that the cards came.
Is this like a 3 week window?
Yeah, it was like a 3 week window.
So when you go to a trade show,
yeah,
and the potential of that happens,
I mean,
do you need to like basically be ready,
or no,
are you
I wouldn't,
really, you are a bit of an anomaly.
This was
maybe
not a normal, and I don't want to,
yeah.
I don't want to, because we've had terrible trade shows since then. Like, I don't want to, they say that at your first, and part of the reason that I wasn't necessarily prepared or expecting anything was because the conventional wisdom says, like,
yeah,
you are very lucky if you get, like, a couple of orders at your first stationery show. And a lot of people do it and never get an order at all. And it's really crowded. It's really hard to stand out. It's a lot of vendors selling the same thing. It's, you know, it's a tough thing. And so,
did you ever walk it before you actually went? You didn't.
I didn't. And I actually am glad because people ask me all the time what I think they should do. And I have a couple answers to that. One is I actually do think it's better to walk the show walk the show just to get an idea of what you're dealing with and like what
yeah.
the level of presentation is expected
yes.
of you.
And even just an idea of the space and
yeah.
like how
and
you might get things up and
right,
you know,
like how that all works.
Yeah.
That's really important. And also knowing what is out there in the industry is really important. And making sure that if you are launching a stationery brand at this time, that it looks really different.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a lot of sameness and stores are really kind of like, I'm not taking on another line that already looks just like this and this and this because I already carry those people. So, like, if you have a new line that's coming out, it's really important that it be your own thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And is this just, quick aside, like, happened recently where things have gotten extra saturated?
It's been like that. I think it's always been true, but I think as Pinterest and social media has gotten more popular, and people are all influenced by the same five things.
Yes.
I think
in the same five color palettes.
And the same everything, you know, I think that it gets, I think that it's more, I think that it's more concentrated now. And I think that it also, stationery is an interesting thing because it has a really low cost of entry to have a company to create a stationery line and manufacture it. Which is awesome. I mean, mm-hmm. I couldn't have afforded to do a gift line, so I did stationery.
Yeah.
But what it also means is that it attracts a lot of people, and you don't necessarily have to be a designer or have a designer background or really know about that stuff. And so you end up, I think, with a lot of people who love the idea of having a stationery company, are really interested in it, have the money to do it, but don't necessarily have the design skill or the design experience to be able to create something that's really new and interesting.
Or a unique point of view.
Right. You know, and you have, so Pinterest makes it really easy, you know, to just sort of copy what already exists. And I think that that's a thing, like, you can probably make really successful wedding invitations doing that. Like, mm-hmm. you can make a ton of money doing that. But
yeah.
if you are trying to make a wholesale line that stores are going to pick up, it's, I think, increasingly difficult to do. Unless you have a really unique point of view. And in that case, it's never hard to do because stores always want something mm-hmm. that is unique. And when my line launched, it really wasn't like anything else. And that was why it got
Your
such a good reception.
Really unique.
And that was why I started writing cards, because there weren't any cards that I felt like really resonated with me, and
yeah.
I really wanted to do something that I didn't see.
We call that scratch your own itch.
Totally,
like mm-hmm. in the whole entrepreneurial space,
right?
Whenever you're trying to solve your own problem,
yeah.
like even if you were frustrated, if someone knew or someone was watching this and they wanted to do something and they were frustrated, it would be like whatever made them want to make something different. Potentially be the thing.
Totally.
You know, when you're looking at the homogenous nature of design because of what we're talking about, whatever that could be to be different
yeah.
that inspires you could be cool.
Yeah, totally. So
yeah.
it was really seeing a problem and a combination of solving my own problem and seeing that there were a lot of other people who weren't, whose needs weren't being met by the choices that were out there at the time, and feeling like I had something else to say that to add to the conversation that would be playing in kind of a different space.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I just didn't, I knew that it was different, and I knew that people, if the right people saw it, I knew that they were liking it because it was going viral online, but I didn't have any real understanding of what could happen at the show. Like, I just honestly had no idea.
Did you have any friends in the space at the time?
I had one, and the way I went to the show actually was really interesting. So, I didn't even really know that the stationery show was a thing. I heard about it first from Lynn Mitchell, who was my Southern California rep for 3 years and who is a lovely person, has been in the business for 30 years.
Stationery
and gift. She has a showroom down in the LA Mart, and she and her group rep Southern California and Arizona. And the way that I found her was when I decided that I wanted to make a wholesale stationery line, I wanted the opinion of a sales rep, like someone who carried...
That's smart.
Well,
yeah,
right,
I
mean, I wanted to know
yeah.
how... I wanted to know how viable the stuff was from the perspective... Because I had a lot of designer friends, and so I knew I had that sort of covered, but what I wanted to know was, is this viable from a sales perspective within this industry? I don't think that I've seen anything like this, but I want to be sure... You know, what do you give me your 2 cents on this? If you're interested. And the way I found her was I thought about paper lines that I really admired, and Rifle was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out, well, they rep Kate Spade, they rep a lot of really Jonathan Adler, a lot of really nice brands, Sugar Paper. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to reach out to them and see what she thinks.
Yeah.
And that was kind of how that worked. And I sent her JPEGs, and then she wrote back to me and we met up, and that was what sort of kicked me off in the direction of the show. And because she was really enthusiastic and
That's
said,
great.
If you can get to the show, we'll rep you. So that was sort of my challenge, because I had 2 months to prepare.
You did.
And do 50 cards and, like, do a whole a catalog.
What, you had 2 months to prepare 50 cards and a catalog?
I did.
Well, so you said you were freelancing and advertising. Mm-hmm. Were you design or writing or both?
I started as an art director 14 years ago. But I was an art director for 5 years, and then I switched and became a copywriter, and then I came up to creative director through that side. So I've done both. And I always... advertising was hard because you had to be one or the other. Like, yeah. If you watch Mad Men, it's exactly that same setup still. It's like an art director and a writer are paired together, and they do concepts together and develop stuff. And I always did both, and I always switched back and forth, but you had to really pigeonhole yourself as one or the other. And then I was, like, 5 years in, I was working on ESPN, which was all, like, low-budget television comedy. And for an art director, there's, like, not that much to do. Like, it's not that fun. But I was loving writing scripts, and we had to write, you know, hundreds of scripts. Like, my partner was drowning in the amount of work that it was, and so I was jumping in and just helping and doing it, and my boss at the time knew that I was into it and said, you know, this is not usual, but we need to hire another writer, but if you want the job, I'll give you the job and we can hire another art director. So that was kind of how that worked, and then I just sort of went on from there as a writer. So, yeah.
And then freelanced.
And then freelanced as a creative director, writer.
Oh, okay.
And then,
what was the moment of stationery or cards? Well, you said you didn't see it out there.
Yeah, the moment that I really felt like, all right, this is really what I want to do, was I had an Etsy shop that I had opened on the side in, like, 2010, and I was selling prints of my work that I was printing. I bought, like, a fancy Epson printer, and I was just illustrating.
I had one of those.
Illustrating, printing, selling prints.
Yeah.
And
with writing at the time? Yeah.
With writing. I was lettering. And I was, but I was doing, it was less of my own writing, and it was before Pinterest, and it was before lettering and quotes was a big thing. And so I was just practicing my lettering.
I remember those days.
Yeah. I was just words as art. That was like before it was a huge thing. I mean, there was, some of it was around, obviously, but it wasn't like it is now. But I was just really interested in getting better at lettering. And so that was how I was practicing, was like doing these quotes. And
what inspired that? Was that just something
I've loved always, forever? Okay. Like during every meeting, every boring science class, everything was just lettering in the margins of my papers. And if I had known like 30 years ago that could be a job, it would have like saved me a lot of time.
Well, the advertising helps now.
Oh my gosh. No. I couldn't do what I'm doing now had I not done advertising first. Like
that's my degree.
So many things in that business that helped me do what I do now. Like I couldn't have built the brand that I built.
It gives you an entrepreneurial mindset. Yeah. I had no idea that's what I was.
I know how to sell an idea. I know how to do a presentation. I know how to think strategically. I know how to like
have a brand,
a ton of ideas at this, and like don't know which ones are terrible and which ones to keep. And you know,
so it's awesome.
Yeah, all of those skills super translated. But yeah, so lettering was a thing that I've always done and been into. And so I was just having fun. Like because I had quit my full-time job to freelance, it was the first time in like 8 years that I had any free time. And so that was what I was doing on the side, was just like drawing pictures and drawing and doing lettering. And then I started thinking, you know, I kind of want to write my own stuff. It feels really weird to write like an inspirational quote of yourself and sell it. Like that's
I'm so glad though, because sometimes I'm like, can we get some current inspirational quotes, please? Well, because we've done everyone.
And also the reason that people don't do them is because of IP.
Yes.
So I mean that's why everyone does like, you know.
Oh, from way back.
Everyone does everything from way back.
Intellectual property.
You can't, I can't do a line from a movie or something that Oprah said and sell it.
Right.
Because it's their intellectual property. But anything that's pre-1923 is public domain. So that's why there's all the old quotes. That's the biggest reason.
That explains it. Well,
you can do it for personal use, you just can't sell it.
Yes. And then I totally get what you're saying, where you're like, am I worthy of my own
quotes? Right, like, am I just going to write, like, what am I going to do, write a thing and then just, like, sell that thing? That feels weird. So I started thinking about cards, really, and it was partially out of necessity and feeling like there really isn't anything. I find myself standing in the store and looking for cards more often than not and making my own cards more often than not. And I can think of five scenarios just off the top of my head where there are a lot of people whose needs aren't being met with what the current card market is offering.
Was a huge turning point for you, one of those thoughts. Yeah. What was the first one that you did?
The first one that I did was a card for the person that you're kind of dating, but not really, because Valentine's Day was coming up. And I started thinking about, and I was in a relationship at the time, but there were many years that I wasn't. And I started thinking about how such a huge percentage of relationships, especially with people who are young, around Valentine's Day are super fraught because you're like kind of seeing someone but not really. And so you have two choices. You can either give them a normal card and then give them like a whole speech like, oh, this isn't that big of a deal. Like, don't read into it. It's cool. Whatever. Just be cool. Or you can just like not do anything. And then that's also weird. And so I was like, you know, I bet that people would really respond if I made something that was designed for those kinds of relationships. Because it also like, when you do that, it legitimizes that kind of a relationship, you know, because you have a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm in this weird ass thing. And like, I feel like everyone around me is in like an awesome couple. And I'm like the only person in this like weird ass thing. And then seeing a card in a store that actually speaks to your situation helps validate your reality and be like, oh yeah, I'm not the only person in this. Like, obviously this is happening for a lot of people. Like, this is a real thing that happens. And so I put that card in my Etsy shop. I just had like 100 printed at a local printer that I found online and had no idea what would happen. And I was very lucky in that Etsy put it on their Facebook page. And it was super random that they did it. I mean, someone must have just been looking through and thought like, this is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And put it on their page. And it ended up being their most liked and most shared post of all of that whole year.
Oh my God. What did that card say? I'm sure we'll show it.
It's really long. It's like a really long, and we call it like the awkward dating card. And it's basically the contents of that speech that you would say to someone. So it's like, I know we're not like together or anything, but it felt weird to not say anything. So I got you this card. It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't even have a heart on it. Basically it's just a card saying hi. And then in like tiny letters, it says, forget it. And at the time there was just nothing like that. Like, yeah. I mean, there was just nothing. And so people went crazy for it, and it was on like BuzzFeed and the front page of Reddit and Funny or Die and College Humor and Cosmo and like all these places just picked up and ran with it. And
you could not have tried for that or predicted that would happen, right?
No. I mean, I felt like, okay, if this gets in front of people
It has potential.
If it gets in front of the right people.
But you didn't say, here, Etsy, here's the thing.
They just happened to see it.
This is before you went to the stationery mm-hmm. show?
This is before I went to the stationery
this
show.
This was, like, the part of your journey that's on the side. Like,
yep.
Where you're
totally
still
on the side, still freelancing.
You had prints, but this was this one of your first cards?
This was the first card.
It was. Mm. Okay.
And I wanted to test it. And I felt like, you know, I think I have something, I think I can add something to this space that's not, and represent something that's not being represented, and I think people are going to respond to it. And I felt like, you know, I'll post that card, and the 10 people who see it, that it speaks to, are going to be so psyched and buy it and be, like, super into it and happy. But I just didn't know that more people than that would end up seeing it, and that's what happened. You know, and I mean, Etsy can post something, and if it doesn't resonate with people, it goes nowhere. But so it ended up having that huge amount of shares and going all over the place and being reposted a million times. And it still pops up on Reddit, like from that very first run with like white envelopes and stuff, like this one picture that like still comes up.
The same image.
Yeah.
Because were you, when you mentioned things going viral, I'm glad you talked about that, because were you keeping a blog at that point?
No, not really. I had like
social media.
No, I mean, I had like a tiny Tumblr blog that like no one read, that was just like my comics and my drawings. And I had an Instagram, I think,
And did you do any outreach at that time?
Not at that time, because I was still experimenting with what's going to work. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I had just started doing a little bit of outreach for my prints, and Design Mom, Gabby, had written about them, had done a little piece about them and showed them.
And she found them, or you?
No, I sent them to her. Because I was doing a lot of kids book quotes, and so I just sent a couple of emails out to some people who had blogs who I thought it would work for their content. Not looking at like sponsored posts or anything, just like, hey, you know, I'm doing this. I'm not seeing anything else like it. And she was like, yeah, this is really cool. I want to feature it. So she did that, and that was really the only thing I've done, and that was like a nice little bump in my Etsy shop, and I was selling a lot of prints. And then the card thing was, I'm going to do this experiment. I'm not doing any, you know, I hadn't done any press. I hadn't done any outreach. I hadn't done anything.
Did you have an email newsletter? No. Not even when you were first doing your Etsy. Was that still a time? I got on 2007, and when I got on, people would just find me. Like, it wasn't so saturated that it was easy. So when you went on, did people
just
know?
It was easier now, but it was definitely not the way that it was back then. I had an Etsy shop briefly in 2008 that was jewelry, like laser cut wooden jewelry that was actually super cool, that I ended up abandoning because my career got too busy. I was doing that on the side too. And it was definitely busier. You know, this was 2011, I got back on Etsy, and this was all happening in like January of 2013. But, one of the things that was really helpful was that Etsy, Facebook hadn't changed their algorithm yet, so that you still saw business posts.
Yes.
So Etsy had all these followers, and people still saw their posts.
Yeah.
So that was very helpful in terms of spreading that first thing around. So really what I learned from that was, okay, I have a thing that, yeah, this could have been like a one-off thing, but I think that I know there's more where this came from, and I have a thing that I want to bring to market here, and I want to figure out how to do that. And I really didn't know all that much about stationery, like, was not my area of expertise. And so that was when I reached out to, I looked up who Rifles Rep was, and I reached out to Lynn and talked to her, and she confirmed, like, yeah, I think this could be really successful, and this is really interesting, and this is really unique. And
that's the 2-month turnaround.
Yeah.
So it went from that Valentine's
Day
to which then you created 50
to the show. So
designs.
I stopped freelancing.
Just done and done.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I was like, all
right,
I'm gonna
take some time off. Was that a scary move for you, or you had
enough? Money saved from freelance, and so I was like, all right, that's what this money is for. Like, I'm gonna take this time off, and I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna just make this work, because I had this person saying to me, I'll rep you.
Yeah.
You know, and she repped some of the lines that I respected, the absolute most, you know, really big names. And so her saying, we'll take you on in our rep group.
Great reputation.
Was like, okay, like, I have to try to make this work. And so I stopped freelancing and just focused on that for 2.5 months. And the other thing that Lynn had told me was, you know, it'll cost you like probably a minimum of $10,000 to go to the stationery
show.
Yeah,
I'm glad you brought that up.
And I was like, yeah, I mean, it really is. That's at the bare minimum. It costs us $25 now. So
is that including staff you bring along?
It includes,
or is that just the show and the product?
No, it includes
the
staff I bring along. It does not include paying them because they're my employees. So it doesn't include like their wages as part of it, but it includes putting them up in New York for a week.
Oh, okay.
Paying for them to eat for a week. All of the expenses of having people
there. And
how
many people do you bring?
Plane tickets.
Now.
Three.
And the first time you brought the first person, you brought one person.
The first time I brought zero people.
You did, okay.
I just did it. Yeah, usually when people do the show the first time, they just do it themselves.
You just did it.
Yeah.
Minimum of $10,000. Is that what
you
spent?
No. So the way that I ended up doing it was, you asked if I knew anyone in stationery, and I had one friend in stationery, and it was my friend Allison Chapman, who owns Igloo Letter Press in Ohio, and she and I had worked together at Minnesota Center for Book Arts, like, in the early 2000s, and she had been going. The only thing I knew really about the stationery show was that Allison had been going to it, and she was really the only person I knew who I could pose any real questions to about anything. So One of the things Lynn said was, yeah, you know, some people cut down on the cost by sharing a booth with someone else. So I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to have 50 cards. I don't even know if that's enough for a whole booth. Like,
how'd you decide on that number?
That was what she recommended. Okay. Just like that a store won't take you on unless you have a minimum of around that number, 40 to 50. And so I called Allison and I said, I want to go to the stationery show. How, like, is this crazy? Could I ever do this? Like, how do I, like, where do I even start? And she was like, well, actually, the show just reached out to us and offered us a bigger space that they offered to put us in a bigger space for a discount because there was this one, they were moving some people around and offered me this bigger spot, and I took it, but I don't know if we have enough stuff to fill it. So if you should come and just bring your stuff, I'm already driving with like my whole crew and our walls and everything from Columbus. So if you just show up with your products and your catalogs, we'll just take care of everything and you can just have a wall and just pay for part of it, which was amazing. And that was really...
Yay for creative community.
So that was basically how I did it. I mean, if I had had 2 months to do it, if I had had 2 months in which I had to do the entire card collection, do a catalog, do a line sheet, learn how to work with a, you know, wholesale, learn all that stuff. And I'd also had to figure out how to go to a trade show, how to build a booth, how to deal with the Javits, how to do all the everything. That would have been too much. Like, in 2 months, I wouldn't have been able to pull it off. You need like a year to plan and figure it out, you know, if you're really going to do it. So the fact that Allison gave me that opportunity and just had it, that was the reason that I was able to go. So I went and I just had a wall. Like I didn't even, you know, I painted my name on it. I just stuck my cards up on the wall. I didn't know, you know, I had no idea what to expect. So then it all sort of went crazy from there. And I ended up moving into my studio like 10 days later. You know,
the one that you're talking about.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
With the amenities.
The amenities.
that weren't there.
The roof. Right. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not know the progression.
Yeah.
That was really, really fast.
Fast.
Mm-hmm. And
it was really fast.
I mean, I'm trying to think about that moment of you, at least you knew you had the viral experience.
Right.
Which prepped you a little. And then thinking about that moment of while you're preparing for that and wondering what you would get at the show to the moment when someone like Urban Outfitters places that order.
Yeah.
Did you flip out a little or were you like, you know, I kind of thought this could have that potential.
Both. I think both. I think.
Did you stay calm?
I flipped out a little like when it actually came in. But knowing what I knew from my decade working and coming, you know, out as a creative director, I knew that I had all of the pieces for something to be successful. And I knew that I wasn't just like, oh, I don't know, I'm just gonna like throw shit at the wall and see if it sticks. Like, I had a very deliberate brand that I was trying to create and a very deliberate plan as to how I was gonna do it and what was on brand and what was off brand, and just really knew that and the way that, and I developed the brand because I wanted to solve a problem that I didn't feel was being solved.
You were
so
clear on all
that. That was really clear. And so I feel like that was another reason that, you know, things went really fast, but a lot of it was because my brain had been
trained
for a decade to be able to get there.
I do like, we're talking about contemporary sayings, I don't know who said this ever, but that idea that luck is when opportunity meets preparation.
Yeah.
It's so true.
Yeah.
It's like these, we do live in that time where still you think someone just, you know, a light switch was flipped and it was just magic and
yeah,
it just worked.
Totally.
And yes, people can be an overnight success, but when you truly look at almost every time you really look at someone's background or get some part of their story, you're like, oh, there was a lot that went into that moment that seemed like it just was lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. Like, there have been a few sort of pieces written about me that are like, overnight success, and it's a little bit like, okay, like, I get, yes, it all happened fast, and I get it, and at the same time, it feels kind of misleading because there was so much that was totally related experience, although mm-hmm. it was not in this field particularly, that went into doing what I did. That, and if I had not had that experience, I definitely wouldn't have been able to create what I did, you know?
And have it be maybe so, like, on point,
yeah,
right,
no, just
away.
Yeah, and have it be honed right away, mm-hmm. you know? And I wouldn't have had all of the skills that I needed in order to be able to put it together because I've been an art director. I am super good at Photoshop. I'm super good at InDesign.
Did you do your catalog?
I did everything. Yeah. I have done every catalog up until the last one. I mean, that's another thing that I think people don't know unless you work for me, and then you really know that I work really hard. And that...
Or we follow your Instagram and on yeah. Fridays, you're like, could there just be more week left?
It's not even... Yeah, I mean... And I'm trying to work less hard, to be totally honest, because
yes.
I'm...
Well, the theory with advertising is that you are working kind of nonstop.
Yeah.
So you were already doing all of that. And I'm sure you didn't go, hey, I'm going to start my company. And then, we all know that you work hard. If not, it should be clear.
Yeah.
You will and you do.
Totally.
But you also have this idea about the freedom and the choice
oh
my
God,
how
yeah.
to allocate your time.
Right.
And
part of the reason I left advertising was because I was like, you know what? I just gave 10 years of like 80-hour weeks to this.
Yes.
And this is not what I want to do anymore. Like, I need my life. I need to be able to make my own choices. I need to be able to... I'm not passionate about this in the way that I was when I was going into it. Like, this isn't the right spot for me. And so I created a job for myself where I actually, like, work more. I mean, I actually, you know what? That's not true. I don't work the kind of hours that I did in agencies. I've never made myself do an all-nighter the way that we had to in agencies.
Well, and the ultimately, let's say that you do, there is so much reward that comes from
oh my God,
knowing
yes.
it's for you.
So much more reward, and it's much more fun. I mean, it's much more,
it doesn't feel like work in the same way. Or
no, it feels, I mean, it of course feels like work in certain times, and I think that it is misleading to say, like, it doesn't feel like work because it's so fun, because, like, a lot of the shit that you have to do when you own a business is, like, it really is work.
Yeah.
And it isn't that fun, but.
And the bigger you get, the less creative time you get.
Yeah. And I definitely, it's a different kind of work. Like, I have a different mindset about it mm-hmm. than I did when I was working in agencies. Because ultimately it's all kind of up to you, you know? And if I work now, like, I can never be like, oh my, like, shitty boss is making me like do an all-nighter or whatever. Like, it's all me, you know, like mm-hmm. But it all is consequences. Like, I could decide, like, you know what, this weekend I don't want to work. Like, I'm going to go to Ojai and like hang out, you know, but then that would mean that we don't launch our new website on Monday that my head of operations has been working on for like 4 months with a web designer and developer and that, you know what I mean? So it's like, yes, they're like, I could make any decision I want at any time, but then there's consequences.
Yes.
And those are, that's a different thing than being
an
employee.
To be a person who feels accountable. And, like,
yeah,
responsible.
Yeah, right. Like, I do, right.
You have those qualities, which is lovely and important as a business owner, I think.
I think you don't get that power as a business owner if you
yes.
are not, because you never do the things that you say you're going to do. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But.
So, where you are, I mean, this part has gone fast, like the 3 years of from that one show
mm-hmm.
to, you know, licensing your company. And then maybe it's a good time to touch upon the decision you're making. So you're in it,
mm-hmm.
you're working
in it, working a ton.
And that decision that you made, it's so great. It's well, just because you're doing it a slightly different route, I think,
yeah.
than most people, and just, I would love to know more
yeah,
about that
Yeah, I'm
choice.
Doing it kind of a weird way right now, where the company was growing super fast, we ended up having to build our own warehouse in Las Vegas in the third year, and I had 15 employees, and it was all just really overwhelming, and what was happening was the creative was super suffering. Like, I was spending almost all my time handling everything else. And then the creative work, because the creative work didn't have to happen during the day, like during normal business hours, and so much other stuff did have to happen during normal business hours in terms of meetings, managing people, working with other, like anything working with other people had to happen during that time. So the creative was like happening really late at night or like happening like super close to a deadline, and it was really suffering. I felt like I didn't have enough time. I was just so burnt out all the time. And so I started thinking about like, well, I have a couple of different options. Like I could bring in a CEO to run the company while I just focus on the creative. Mm-hmm. And we could move out of our office and move into like a real bigger space and, you know, really kind of go for it and really try to just build it that way. I looked at a bunch of different things because we also were looking at our finances and our model, business model, and being like, all right, well, we sell about 40% of our revenue comes from our website and about 60% comes from wholesale. But wholesale requires about 10 times the infrastructure as our website does. The website is just like a customer service person, someone, you know, a couple people to ship orders. And then you have to make sure that your website is working. Mm-hmm. And like, but that's kind of it. And like social media and stuff. And then wholesale is just a whole other thing, you know, where it's like trade shows alone were costing us $200,000 a year. And printing all the catalogs and doing all and working with all 70 of the reps and doing all the in-house repping and all of the sales staffing and all of the traveling. And it was just that part of it was such a beast. And then we started manufacturing gift, and that was also just really logistically challenging when you start working overseas and you start doing these big runs and you have to store them and you have to predict a season ahead and you have to like do all the stuff that we didn't know how to do. And we were just kind of making it up. It was really stressful and it was really, it was just hard, you know? And so I started looking at where our actual profit was coming from with the business and looking at what I wanted to be doing and looking at kind of what was actually working. And so we thought, well, maybe one option is we stop making gift entirely and we just are a card company. Like, totally viable decision. Red Cap did it, like, and it worked really well for them. Like, totally viable choice. But I am a creative person. I really like doing the gift. So it was like, no, I don't want to do that. And then it was like, okay, we could wholesale cards only and just do the gift on our website. But then our stores would get really mad. So we were like, all right, that's not a good idea. Our stores, we have too many retailers, so we get too angry and like, we don't want to upset them and that would be terrible. Yeah. So we're looking at our numbers and 60% was,
so your,
our revenue was wholesale.
Our customers are everything. Bottom line, done. But you were just saying, in particular, you don't want to alienate your wholesale customers.
Exactly. And I was
by taking away the gift. That would be terrible.
That would be terrible. They would be mad and we wouldn't, you know, and I don't want to do that. So that wouldn't, and we had worked super hard to build a good relationship with all of our stores and we were in like 1,700 stores at the time. So it was like, that seems like a bad idea. So I started thinking like, well, what else, how else could I do this? Like, what else could I do? And, you know, because there was a part of me that at certain days was like, I just don't even want to wholesale anymore. Like, I want to just take this all back and just sell directly online. And then I was like, no, I can't do that. Like,
what is it really quickly that, cause that's, I know I've even talked to you about this at one point, that decision of going one way or the other or trying to do both. Yeah. What was that that made you want to focus on the retail side maybe instead? Is it just logistically
way
more complicated?
Wholesale is incredibly complicated. Wholesale, you make less than half the profit. Retail, you can make a lot more thing. You don't have to worry as much about a margin on a product. Part of what's really difficult is getting the margin good enough so that the price can be low enough that you can then wholesale it. In the gift, in particular, paper, it's not a big deal, but in gift, it's really hard. And so, for example, if we didn't wholesale and we just sold on our website, you have a mug that sells, instead of for $9 or $7.50, which we sell it at wholesale, it would cost, you know, $18 on our website. So you just need to be able to make a margin that can make you make a decent profit at $18 and not at $7.50.
And you talked a little bit about this. You know, you were trying to produce in the States or manufacture.
Yep.
But it's so complicated. It's like, how can you set that price that will be competitive within the marketplace, also try to produce within our country, yeah. which is more expensive? I mean,
yeah, it's really hard.
I don't know how anyone does it and the way anyone makes a profit ultimately.
Yeah. And you can, I mean, if you are, you can make things here if you are only, I mean, and people do make things here for wholesale as well, but it's much easier to make things here if you are just selling direct to customer.
Okay.
Because you can have a thing cost more, you know, like the mug could cost $6 to make and I could still sell it at $18 and make money. If the mug costs $6, I can't sell it to my stores for $7.50 because that there's no profit there built in for us. You know, that doesn't even go towards, that doesn't even cover the cost of the wages for the people who are packing it, you know? And so let alone any profit or any coverage of overhead. So it's, wholesale is, wholesale can be great.
It's high volume is
but
what you're
high
after.
Volume, yeah, you need high volume and you need products with good enough margins and you need products that are not really difficult to make. I mean, I think what a lot of people get into, I have a lot of friends who are in like more of a maker wholesale space, more of an artisan making their own stuff, and they are so psyched because they get a huge order from Anthropologie or something, which is awesome. But then they're like, oh my God, I have to make like 4,000 lavender sachets, or I have to make all of these things, you know, instead of...
In 2 weeks.
Right, in 2 weeks. I mean, it's usually, right. And it's just, and whereas for me and what we do, it's calling a manufacturer and saying, here's some art, I need you to make this, which is, so I'm not making the thing, you know, but I think that that's another big consideration because we have this like mindset and it's because like everything in our culture is like more, better, bigger. Like if you're good, like be better. If you are a small time, be Diane von Furstenberg or whatever.
Right,
and
so
I just didn't even think in the beginning, like that's maybe hard. Wholesale doesn't make sense. Like, wait, do I even want a wholesale or like, do I have a good thing going if I build my retail store, you know? And I just immediately was like, wholesale, like I have to do this. Like I have to be a hustle name, you know, whatever. I mean, not really, but it was like, that was how I felt I was success. Like success for me was like synonymous with that. But when I try to look back at why, like there's no reason why. All it is just that that was like what I thought based on like nothing, based on like our culture, like reality TV. I don't even know, you know, like,
based on social media.
You can actually make more money, like profit-wise, and have a nicer life a lot of the time if you just sell direct to customer and you don't wholesale at all, you know? And so I think we don't talk about that enough. You know, if you're a store and you're watching this, don't be mad, but that's kind of, you know.
Well, that's how I've done it this whole time. Like, I licensed from the beginning.
Yeah.
Just because it's worked out well. And I still have that same partner in the licensing company, and I'm glad for that. But there was a part of me that knew enough to know I had started a different company in the tech space. And so there was this whole mentality, do you want a lifestyle business? Like, or what's your exit strategy? Like, whatever that would be.
Right.
And I just automatically went into this business thinking about that. And, you know, the conversations
really
I would
smart.
Have with people and say, what I also realized is that the majority of my income, even to this day, even with multiple contracts, has come from my direct-to-customer.
Mm-hmm.
They're so valuable to me that I don't want to sacrifice anything for them because I have people who followed me this whole time.
Yeah.
But that was all. It was almost by accident. It was just, although, you know what, I did actually do the Atlanta show with a completely different product. And so I had enough of that experience where I was trying to hand paint a furniture wedding line. I'm like, oh my God. Like right away I was like, that's insane.
Yeah.
And just the whatever few orders I got almost was too much for one person to do.
Right.
So maybe that was part of what caused me to just automatically be so thankful for like creating something and sending it to the customer.
Yeah.
And they're really thrilled and there's enough profit margin for me to make it that I'm not like panicking over high volume and
Yeah,
and it took a while for me, actually, to ramp up to even be selling, like, to more people and to get myself out there.
Yeah.
So there was no question, really, of, like, wow, let me take this. But I don't think I would have known either to, like, the way you approached it going to a rep. But anyway, it's interesting to hear you say that because that's something I've often questioned, like, why haven't I pushed it bigger?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when I started getting picked up with licensing, like, my art was in Urban Outfitters.
Yeah.
What if I was the person that sold to them? And there's, I have questions.
So much headaches. Myself. Like, it's great in some ways. I mean, yeah, like, it's, you can make money, but you can also, like, eat all that money in, like, infrastructure costs. Like,
right.
there's a balance. I mean, like, there's ways to do it, but it does take a tremendous amount of work that is, a lot of the time, not the kind of work that a creative person wants to do.
Right.
And so that's just, it's hard, you know? I mean, like, yes. I never really understood what the word infrastructure meant until I had a business. And now I feel like it's, like, every third word I say. It's like, infrastructure, infrastructure. But, like, it's really, like, it's a really thing. It's a really big thing.
Can you please make an entrepreneur's line? Yeah. Like, now that we have all these. Yes.
I know so many people.
That you're an entrepreneur. Yeah. Do you have your infrastructure?
I sometimes want to ask people, like, what, if they know what the word profit means. Because trying to price ourselves as artists in a marketplace, well, with the fact that you have to keep gift at a certain price point. Mm-hmm. And then we're trying to compete with that and then also compete with people who just aren't thinking about their infrastructure or any part of their business and whether they can truly be profitable.
Right.
Sometimes I've looked at someone in the space and I've done the math and I'm like, how are they making that work? Because by the time they're even if they're going gangbusters,
yeah,
and they're selling for this and then they've got to add on that time and then they've got to add on the envelope that they're shipping it in,
right,
and all of these various factors, how is there any room left to actually make a not even just a living, like something, like,
right,
some kind of profit,
right,
and yet I need to compete with that in a marketplace.
That's really hard.
And I need to be, you know, as big as you're saying. And the, I mean, it's just, it gets really complicated.
It gets really hard. I think for me, I kind of decided early on to keep that I want, so our customers aren't buying my stuff because of price. I mean, yes, if our mugs cost $40, people probably wouldn't buy them, but people will pay. What my goal is to make something that people really want enough that they will pay an extra $2 for it. Because I need to charge that much in order for any of this to make sense. You know, like,
yes,
in order to compete
otherwise
with
you're just like
Target
running
and in
numbers.
Order to compete with, you know, and we're not, it's not like we're competing with Target. I mean, Target's mugs cost $5, but like,
right.
So you have to be in that space. I mean, if Target's mugs cost $15, you could make your mugs cost $30, but they don't, you know? So everything, those prices are all sort of set. And so really I think that for a small business to try to compete at all on price is just a bad strategy.
Yes.
And the goal should be to make a thing that
is special
and yeah, that is not
meaningful for people.
Yeah. That is meaningful enough and that differentiates itself enough that people are going to want to pay an extra few dollars for it. And at least pay, you know, and also if you're a small business person, making sure that you are pricing your stuff so that you are making a profit. I mean, that's being the biggest thing. Sure.
I'm glad that you say that because really in that time of Etsy and when it started, there was more of a movement towards really appreciating handmade.
Right.
And I think what has happened with the saturation of the marketplace through all of the things we've just talked about,
mm-hmm,
is that people do feel like they need to compete,
right,
with a Target or, you know, maybe not entirely, but I think I see handmade people trying to get that mentality.
Totally.
And not really feel like they can charge. Maybe they, you know, it's not their fault either.
Right.
It's like they don't feel like they can charge what it's truly worth.
Right.
To, you know, if you handcraft something,
I know,
it's time.
And the other thing, though, that's so interesting about pricing is perception of value. Like, we've raised and lowered the prices on our things as we've changed manufacturers a couple of times. And we don't sell any fewer tote bags at $20 than we did at $24. Like, if people want that tote bag, they're going to,
yes,
buy it.
Yes.
And, in fact, I know people who have had others have the opposite happen where they charge more and their sales go up, especially on a place like Etsy, like, where there's a million, I mean, it was the sort of case in point, like, my head of operations, Charlie, has had an Etsy shop since 2006. Like, she was one of the first Etsy shops, and it's called Minor Thread, and she sells lavender sachets and teas and all kinds of like cool necklaces and stuff. And we were just talking about, because on Etsy, if you go and look for a lavender sachet, there are a million, right? Like, so you can make your lavender sachet special by like sewing it really well and having really nice fabric and like doing this and doing that and doing whatever. But what's interesting is that the people who present their thing nicely and who charge like $34 for it have way more sales than someone who has maybe a very similar thing and charges like $16 for it. And it's because when you're a consumer and you're looking at that thing, a lot of it is like, well, this is like twice as expensive, so it must be like way better. I'm just going to get it because it must be way better, you know? And of course, like, we're all talking about things that are like under $50, but like, I think that perception of value, like the more that I think about it and the more experience I have, psychologically, there really is something there.
Yeah, well, there was a moment, there's a site where you could track where you were in the Etsy sales.
Yeah.
And I came across it, and for a long time, I was like in the top 50 or the top 100 art sellers mm-hmm. on Etsy. And it was mostly prints. It was on the higher end.
Yeah.
And I thought, I actually proved it to myself because I thought, well, I'm still actually selling volume in comparison, and I'm working less because I'm not having to sell as many
exactly.
to get the profit.
Right.
And I just thought, why, you know, but since that time, it does feel like people have just continuously,
yeah.
when
well,
it was before the economy first hit its moment.
Yeah.
And then it just
chipped
away.
Well, I think Etsy too has had, in their relaxing their restrictions, there are more and more and more like Alibaba type sellers that are on Etsy that are just selling whatever for like super cheap. And the customer that wants those things has also started to come to Etsy. And so it's a different kind of customer than was on Etsy 5 or 6 years ago.
Yes.
And it's a different kind of mentality, you know?
It's all changed.
We still have an Etsy shop, but we only do, I mean, and we were number one in the paper category on that, on Craft Count for a year and a half. And then we made a really concerted effort to move people to our site.
Yes.
And we now only bring in, I think this year it'll be like 5% of our revenue will come from Etsy, of our direct-to-customer revenue will come from Etsy. It's like almost nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't want to say that that's good. I'm so thankful for the time at Etsy,
mm-hmm.
you know, but however, in many ways, we were all building their brand.
Right.
And a lot of people came to rely upon it, and I'm sure they couldn't either. Like, you couldn't predict where it was all going.
No.
And then when it started to shift and you were reliant upon that, it was really disheartening to be like, oh, whoa, you know, I might actually need to put a marketing mm-hmm. plan in place. I might need to start advertising because mm-hmm. all of these things that were kind of just unspoken and happened for people who had unique point of views
right.
didn't happen as easily
right.
as they once did.
And the I'm feeling like you can't control, I mean, that was what started to really freak me out about Etsy, was feeling like I couldn't control people's exposure to my brand. Like, they could change their algorithm and no one would see my stuff, like, all of a sudden. And you could go from number one to number nothing, you know?
Yeah.
And when you've had to then put in an infrastructure, there it is again, but like, when you've had to like hire staff and do and fill in all of this, all these people around you to support the volume of business
oh,
that you're doing
well,
when you are number
everyone.
One, then you're responsible for all that. You're in a lease. You have really expensive inventory. You have like, you know, a warehouse, you have all this stuff. And so then Etsy changes their algorithm, and what happens? You, like, are
I didn't realize
gone.
They had an algorithm they changed.
No, they tweak it all the time. Like, for, yeah.
It was before or after that.
Yeah, they tweak it all the time. So what we ended up doing, after looking at all these different options, and everything was problematic in different ways, was partnering with the Madison Park Group in Seattle on our wholesale manufacturing and distribution. So what that means is, they took the wholesale part of the business in terms of all of the infrastructure. My sales manager, my head of sales, is now their employee. They took a couple of our employees and hired them to do their same jobs. And so I work with Madison Park to develop all of our products. So I have a sourcing person over there, which I never had before, to help me with production and product development. So I do all the art. It's not a creative direction situation. So they don't dictate what I make. I just do all the art the same as before and just send them the files instead of us managing the production and printing and everything. They print, they get everything manufactured and everything ships to their warehouse in Seattle. And then all of the sales come in through their customer service team and our sales and the sales manager, who was my former sales manager. And everything gets shipped out from their warehouse in Seattle. And then we buy product from them to sell on our website. So we still manage the whole web half of the business, and that's all totally still us. And then the Madison Park thing is more of a collaboration. Instead of me managing all of the money end of it, I just get a licensing back end percentage from them in exchange for them taking on all of the distribution and all of the manufacturing. And that eliminated my need for having so many employees
in the space here.
In LA. Here in super expensive Los Angeles. It eliminated a lot of just the complications of the things that we were trying to manage in-house. It eliminated the need to get a bigger warehouse, which we were going to have to do, and break our lease on the old warehouse, which would have been a pain. It eliminates the need for us to spend $12,000 a month on an office space here, which is what we were looking at spending, because that's how much rent is here for what we needed.
Yes.
So it's it makes it easier for me to do gift, like, because they have an experienced team there that has been making gift for a long time. And gift is really hard to make compared to paper. Like, yes. It's just so many more moving parts, and it takes a year to develop a thing, and it's just the back and forth and the, like, you have to work with the right factory. Like, there are just so many things that can go wrong. And so having support there from people who know what they're doing is a huge, huge, huge plus. And that was something I couldn't have done on my own. Like, we have two new gift categories coming out in 2 weeks. And then we have another two more whole new categories coming out in January. And then another two or three more coming out in May and July. So, and that was stuff that I couldn't have done that.
Yeah.
It was taking us, we were doing, one category per year was, our goal for being able to release something. So this is, the goal is to be able to grow the brand much more quickly and much more effectively than I could on my own.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's cool. It's good. It's really good.
I don't know if, to wrap up, I don't know, I'm like, did you actually answer, how you make the decision as you're about to, to go through and graphically adjust images this weekend for your site on Monday, the decision of when you take it over versus when you hand it off, that it does still fall on you, even with all these amazing people there to help you?
Oh, yeah, totally.
How you make that decision, and then lastly also, sort of, if you can narrow it down to just one of the things that you've learned in this span of time going from here to this place you're at now.
So what's the exact question?
Well, just those moments when, even though you have all this help, that moment when you're like, oh, I just am going to step in and do this myself.
Well, it depends. And I'm not an expert at it. There are people who are better delegators than I am, and that's something that I'm constantly, constantly, constantly working on. And it really depends. It depends on who you have around you and what their skill sets are and stuff a lot of the time too. I generally, for me, because the brand voice is so important, social media is a really good example. I do all my own social media, and I tried to have someone else do it, and it didn't work. And so that's a thing that I have to keep. And so I keep the pieces that I basically that no one else can do, or that, in the case of this weekend, finding a designer and doing all that stuff last minute and then having to manage them would be expensive and also take probably as much time as it would for me to just do it.
Yeah.
So
you just weigh all the different
the
pros and the cons.
Yeah.
So what would be, if there's anything that you want to share, or what would be one thing that you would want as a takeaway from someone, or one of the questions you get asked?
I would say one of the big things that I've learned is that what looks like it's working for someone else isn't necessarily what's going to work for you. And the reality of doing this big, huge thing is really difficult in a lot of ways. And it's not for everyone. And it doesn't mean that you're not successful if you don't go down this path and if you deliberately choose to stay small. I also think, you know, I know that there's so many different things that we can do as creative people. Like, I have a hard time saying no to all of to them, which is why I'm really overextended kind of all the time. And I am learning how to be better at saying no. But I look at like what friends of mine are doing and I'm like, oh my God, like she has all these books out and like, this person's doing all this, and like this person's doing these classes, and like this
that
looks
happens
so good.
To you too.
Oh my God, it happens to me all the time. Now I'm like, shit, I should do that, and then I'm like, no, like
you're almost an household name.
Like I should just focus on what I'm doing and focus on like even less of what I'm doing. Like narrow it down to like three things instead of like try to do eight things. And I think that there are just so many different paths and so much choice, and because we see so much of what our friends are doing and people who we aren't even our friends, people we just know through social media and what we perceive them to be doing versus what, I mean, who knows if it's what they're actually doing, but it's our perception is like, oh God, I'm not doing that. And I should do this and I should do this other thing and whatever. And like, there's a reason I'm not teaching classes, and it's because like, I couldn't possibly take on anything else. And the people who are teaching classes are not also like running a company, you know? And so pick a thing and it's okay. Like if you're not like,
maybe that would be the theme
of
this.
For me,
pick a thing.
That's for me as much as anyone else. Like, just pick a thing, you know?
Yeah, and just be okay with it.
Yeah.
Go with the flow. And
yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Emily.
Thank you!
Thanks for tolerating my lack of batteries and full-on preparation.
Of course. Anytime.
We'll put it together.
Anytime.
Creative Thursday is recorded and produced by me, Marisa. You can find all things Creative Thursday at creativethursday.com and creativethursdaycourses.com. The blog is back. Did I mention? The blog is back. You might even be listening to this episode at the blog. So if you would like to leave a comment, leave a review, share this with a creative friend you know would love some extra inspiration today, this week, as they start building their business or are just going through the everyday challenges that accompany the life of entrepreneurship, and they want a little reminder that they're not alone on the journey, be sure to share this episode. And thank you, as always, for all of your feedback and your great comments. And you can find all things Emily McDowell at emilymcdowell.com. And again, at her Instagram, Emily McDowell, it's MCDOWELL _, or at Emily on Life is a great one to follow as well, with a lot of her philosophy on life. Much of which I know is born out of this whole experience of building a rocket ship business for sure. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, friends.